So did anybody want to ask a question regarding the homeworks? Yes.
I know about the groups, the sequence is increasing or decreasing, but how about the boundaries?
Well, you have to find some general pattern, right? Like if all the terms in the sequence are positive, if you can prove that, then zero is a lower bound, right? You have to find some kind of pattern. Now, I mean, you know, for a more specific, you know, sequence, I can say more, right? So tell me more about the sequence, and I can tell you more about the patterns I see. Okay. Very, very, very general question, very general answer. It's hard to be more helpful than that.
Do you think you can do like maybe one homework problem just to see like how close we are to what it might
be? What are you interested in?
Just any problem in general.
Any problem. Well, if it doesn't matter to you, I mean, I can make up a new problem. Here's one thing from the homework that was like, look at number two, okay? From day two, right? Given claim that the sequence of B's is bounded. The sequence of A's is obviously bounded. That's given to you. They're between 0 and 1. Well, I claim the B's actually have the same bound, right? All you have to do is round down to 0 and round up to 1. That's a short and simple proof. If there were negative numbers inside the product, then I could be in all sorts of trouble, right? But all the numbers involved were positive or zero. So if I rounded up any factor, it rounded up the product. So I just rounded up all the factors, and I just rounded up the whole product. If that pattern wasn't obvious to you at first, then the thing to do is fill in some specific examples. You know, make up an example of the sequences if necessary, until you see the pattern. And then once you see the pattern, then you can state it in general form like that. There was another problem, I think it was the one involving the binomial theorem, where I told people, try and prove it for n equals 7 or n equals 8, and then see the pattern, and then generalize. Okay. That was an easy one. Other questions? Longer proofs take longer to write, of course. What I'll do is I will I'll grade these, and as it says in the syllabus, after I give them back, you'll have 2 weeks to submit a revision if you want.
Okay, how does the revision work? Would it be like the average of the two? Or?
Yes, that's spelled out in the syllabus too. Yes.
little quirk in the notation here. Remember this, the subscript is just a notation for function application, right? You're thinking of A as representing a function, N as an input. Then we give it a superscript and it means something totally different. Here A is not a function, A is a constant, and we're taking the nth power of it.
Superficially similar notation, but very different meaning. Always be on the watch
for communication. I'll just remark about some other sections of the book in this chapter. Section 3.5 has good tips on writing limit proofs. They don't say exactly the same thing I say, but you can combine what I said with what the book says to good effect, I think. In some ways, the book would say that some of my proofs are... the formatting could be improved a little bit.
That's probably right.
Sometimes I try and fit as much as I can on one line.
So I can fit as much as I can on one board, for better or for worse. With unlimited paper, I might make my proofs a little prettier, like the book suggests.
Anyways, that's just some formatting. There's also some substantive stuff in here, which I wholeheartedly endorse. Let's see. 3.6 and 3.7, I think those are skippable. Those are interesting. They talk about sequences where each term in the sequence is defined using an integral, and the function you're integrating depends on n, or the limit of integration depends on n. But in the interests of time, I'm skipping them. All right. So, going to infinity. Okay. So let's recall the limit for the convergence to a real limit. When L is a real number, you have a certain meaning. Here's kind of the abbreviated form. It means that for epsilon positive, you have A sub n is epsilon close to L, or n sufficiently large. Right. It's nice and compact, and it's easier to read, right? For every positive epsilon, no matter how small, eventually, the sequence will always be epsilon close to L, right? If you wait long enough. There may be exceptions early on, but if you wait long enough, there'll be no more exceptions. You're epsilon close to L. More explicitly, you end up with something like this. How long do you have to wait? That depends on epsilon. That's the subtlety that you might miss if you read that too quickly. I like to emphasize that there's a function, often one we can get a formula for, each positive epsilon and each lowercase n that satisfies our weighting criterion. You wait this long and then you finally get the epsilon closeness. And remember what this means. It just means
you are strictly between L minus epsilon and L plus epsilon. And that is often conveniently written in terms of absolute values. Now, that's as we were doing Monday. Now, there's a very analogous thing for an infinite limit. We'll focus on positive infinity. The limits going to negative infinity are totally analogous. Let's just focus on one of them in the interest of time and clarity. So now we can't say, well, for every epsilon, you eventually get epsilon close to this number. What does it mean to be close to infinity? Right? Sequences larger and larger. 1, 10, 1,000, 1,000,000, 1,000,000,000,000,000. Am I any closer to infinity? Infinity's still infinitely far away, isn't it? So that's not quite going to work. We can't really say we're getting close to infinity unless we make up some new definition of close. So we're just going to say that for any positive cutoff value, you eventually get above that and stay above that. So your sequence might be less than 1,000,000,000,000,000 some of the time, but eventually it's above 1,000,000,000,000 and always will be above 1,000,000,000,000 thereafter. So it's the same kind of phenomenon that we say, okay, there's some goal, and you get closer to the goal in some abstract sense after finding any exceptions. You stay close, that close to the goal. But here, closeness, just abstractly, you really just think, okay, you get and stay above some number. So how about this? For each positive number m, and now here with the epsilons, you're thinking epsilon is small and positive, right? That's your interest in getting really close to L. Now you should be thinking, this could be a really big number. Yes, it could be small, but the interesting case is when you prove that the sequence gets big and stays big. And so again, you could write it in abbreviated notation. You could write the terms are at least m, right, for n sufficiently large. And we could make that more explicit. We could give some actual function that tells us how long we have to wait. And we demand, okay, there must be a function that tells us how long we have to wait. So now the function will depend on m, right? I could have used the same symbols, and I could have used epsilon in both places if I wanted, but I just pick a different symbol to emphasize a different intended meaning here. We're focused on large m. There is. That's where it's just the large m. The function will work for any positive m, but the interesting values will be the large ones. So there's a function now n of m such that for each m positive and each lowercase n where we've waited long enough according to our weighting function. Now instead of having a n be epsilon close to L, we just have it be greater than or equal to n. If you want, you could require an be strictly greater than m. I don't care. I mean, if eventually you're going to be greater than or equal to 1,000,001, then eventually you're going to be strictly greater than 1,000,000. So, same thing. Right? We talked about how with the epsilons, if you prove something like this inequality here with less than or equal to's, then you could just change your weighting function by adding. You just change your weighting function to make them strict. Since
No, we talked about like changing the weighting function here. If this was strict, you could change it to make it not strict. You can do a similar thing here. But anyways, that's getting into a bunch of meta stuff. Let's do a concrete example first. Is work backwards. So instead of let epsilon be greater than zero, let m be greater than zero. And I'm going to work backwards from what I've got here. A sub m greater than equal to m, in this case, square root of n. Let's put it on the next line. Square root of n greater than equal to m. Okay, well, these are positive numbers. So if we square them, we're not going to change the order. Okay, well that's it. Just wait until n is at least m squared, and then your square root is greater than equal to m. So if you want to be very explicit, you can say that this weighting function witnesses the way of your claim. I'm not sure you even need to say this much. I mean, if you understand, and your audience understands this definition of an infinite limit, then this little equivalence here should make it clear, right? If n is at least m squared, then you've waited long enough for the sequence values, the square roots, to be at least m. So if you want to get the sequence to be a trillion, and stay above a trillion, well, you just need to wait until your n's are at least a trillion squared. Then the sequence, the terms in the sequence will all be a trillion bigger. What is a trillion squared? Septillion?
Is it safe to say, so you just have to solve for n to get the n?
Pretty much, yeah. Okay. I mean, you saw how last time, sometimes it was too complicated to solve for n, so we had to round things up or something. Mm-hmm. So that can come up. This one, we're going to have to do a little bit of rounding. Now, last time, what we were doing was you wanted to show something was small, but it was complicated. So you rounded it up to something simpler, but still small, and concluded that your complicated thing was small, because you rounded it up to something simpler. Okay, so here is the other way around. We have something that is complicated, and we want to show it's big. So we round it down to something simpler, and show the simpler thing is big. And then we conclude with the original. Okay, so just like our limit proofs on Monday started with let epsilon be greater than zero, we start these with let n be greater than zero. All right. And why don't I just get the rounding out of the way right now? Just factor out an n. Well, let's just go ahead and divide through n. N squared over n is n. And then you have a minus 1 over n. Okay. Let's see here. This sequence doesn't even make sense at n equals 0, does it? So the sequence is going to have to start at n equals 1. All right. So what I want to do here. So this is a little bit tricky here because of the negative signs, right? What happens if I round the n in the denominator down to 1? What's going to happen to the whole quantity? Well, if you round the denominator of a fraction down, you're rounding the whole fraction up, right? Ah, but there's a negative sign there. So rounding up
So if you're rounding up a positive number, you're rounding down its opposite, right? So the minus sign makes this a little trickier, but I claim that because of that, to round this down to 1. And this is actually true. I mean, think about what would happen if you plug in a number other than 1. Right? What could this be? I mean, it's supposed to be an integer, so excluding the undefined division by 0, this could be 1, 2, or 3. So like n minus a half. Well, that's more than n minus 1. Or n minus a third. Yes, that's more than n minus 1. So yeah, the rounding is right there. And a more formal version of justify this would just say, well, okay, the terms in the fraction are positive, so rounding down the denominator is rounding up the fraction. Then the negative sign switches inequality, so you're actually rounding down the whole negative of the fraction. And then adding n to both sides, which is unchanged. Oh, okay, so you're just rounding it down. The negative signs, the reciprocals can make things tricky, but if you keep track of it, you get something. There we go. So I've rounded it down to something pretty simple, n minus 1. But I think I can do it now, right? So here we go. N squared minus 1 over n will be greater than or equal to m if our rounded down thing is greater than or equal to m. If this is bigger than m, then our original fraction must be even bigger still. And so it will also be bigger than m. And this is, now it's easy to solve. So after rounding down, then I was able to solve for n, as we might say. So the wait time in this case could be m plus 1. Now since I rounded down, that might not be the optimal wait time. Maybe you don't actually have to wait m plus 1, but I don't care. I just know that this is waiting long enough. And all I need to give you is a function that waits long enough. I don't need to find the best one. I just need to find one of the correct waiting functions. Questions or I've said a few things enough times that I should write them down as some kind of slogan. Right? To prove something complicated is small. Round it up to something simple that you can still prove is small.
And when you're trying to prove an infinite limit and it's complicated,
to prove that something's big, round it down to something simple and prove that the simple thing's big.
Oh.
Okay. Now, let's see. Let's do something a little meta now.
Okay.
Two claims. One. If you have a sequence that goes to infinity, then the sequence of its reciprocals goes to zero. Two. Things also work the other way around. Let's say the only caveat is you might have to worry about signs. If you have a sequence that converges to zero and it's always positive, then the sequence of its reciprocals goes to positive infinity.
Right.
A sequence of small negative numbers would have big negative reciprocals, so that might not go to positive infinity, right? Go to negative infinity. Or you can have something really bad where the sequence goes to zero, but it oscillates between positive and negative, even though it's getting small and smaller and smaller. It could be oscillating between positive and negative. Close to zero, but keeps going around from left side to right side, zero, or above and below, if you prefer. And then the reciprocals would oscillate between positive big and negative big, and so they wouldn't go to infinity or negative infinity. Let's see. These are nice because they don't take too long to prove, and they work very directly with the definitions over there. Okay. So like this one. First claim. Okay, so what do we need to do? We assume we have a weight function. Right? So this weight function is supposed to witness that we go off to infinity. So for all positive m and all lowercase m that wait long enough, our sequence is at least m. So whenever you want to prove an if-then, the direct approach is assume the if, prove the then. So let's assume we've got the witness of going to infinity. Right there. All right. Fine. Now, that's stating the if in a more algebraic and hence a more useful way. Instead of just this abstract notation here, arrow infinity. Now it's all just primitive algebraic inequalities. Okay, now I need to get this. Now I'm trying to prove a limit statement where I'm converging to a real number. So that proof, now that I'm getting into, needs to start with a let epsilon be positive, right? Okay. Epsilon close to zero. That's what I want. Okay. Well, this is equivalent to an being between negative epsilon and epsilon. Okay. Well, I'd really like the negative numbers stuff to go away. Let's see. Well, oh, that's no problem. I know that this thing's going off to infinity, so there can't be negative terms, at least not forever. Maybe there's finitely many negative terms, but let's say you plug in 1, right? For the m, right? Well, then all your ans are at least 1, and hence positive. So you don't. So if we wait long enough, we won't have to worry about any negative sequence terms. There might be some initially, but eventually there will be no more because we're going off to infinity by assumption. So then, getting rid of the problem of negative terms, we can just take reciprocals. An is, let's see, all I need is, I'm trying to think of the least bad way to write this. Here is not the an, I want the 1 over an. That's important. I don't know if that blue shows up. That's what I'm trying to do. All right, I'm going to show 1 over an goes to 0. So we're assuming the sequence goes to infinity. We want to prove the reciprocal sequence goes to 0. This is okay. So how do I get it between plus or minus epsilon? Well, I've already shown that if you wait long enough, everything is positive. And hence the reciprocals are positive. So the greater than negative epsilon is taken care of. The other part I need is the less than epsilon. Well, but just take reciprocals of this inequality. If an is positive, then the order just gets flipped. 1 over an is less than epsilon if and only if 1 over epsilon is less than an. So how long do we have to wait for that to happen? Well, let's see here. I could do the old plus one trick. Right. And then this is implied by waiting long enough. How long do I have to wait? Well, I know that for any m, this waiting function tells me how long I have to wait until I'm at least that big. So if I just wait this long, if I wait this long, then the sequence will have committed to being at least 1 over epsilon plus 1, hence strictly greater than 1 over epsilon. Hence the reciprocal sequence will be strictly less than epsilon. Assuming I'm not doing something with negative numbers there. So put it all together. Okay. So if you have n greater than or equal to whichever of these two wait times is longer, then you'll get both of the things you want. You'll get that an is positive because you waited long enough for it to be at least 1, which implies that the reciprocal is positive, which means that you're going to be greater than negative epsilon. And the other waiting time is just what we needed to get the reciprocal less than epsilon. So this would be our wait function that tells us how long should we wait to be sure we're always going to be epsilon close to 0 from now on. And it's roughly what you'd expect. There's just a few little wrinkles to have to deal with. Oh, maybe there's a negative number, or in this definition, I used a greater than or equal to n, sort of a strictly greater than. Whereas over here, in the epsilon close definition, it's a strictly smaller than epsilon. A few mismatches, but by doing things like putting a plus 1 here and taking the maximum with the wait time for 1, I patched up the little mismatches. Okay. Now, all of those little mismatches are just artifacts of the ways we formalize the definition. Intuitively, this all makes perfect sense, right? If for large n, your sequence terms are large and positive, then the reciprocals are small and positive for large n. So it's going to 0. This is just fleshing it out in order to match the definitions I chose over there. Questions about this meta argument here? You can do a similar thing for number 2. Okay, that's for your homework. So you can prove the other one. That should be a relatively easy homework assignment. My wait time for the infinite limit only promises me that the sequence will be greater than or equal to a number m, right? Whereas what I wanted was strictly less than 1 over epsilon. So since the definition wasn't quite giving me what I wanted, I said, okay, to be strictly greater than 1 over epsilon, I can just be greater than or equal to something that's a little bigger. So I just added 1 to make it a little bigger. I could have added a fifth, or I could have added 500. Still would have proved it. So as long as I just picked something a little bit bigger than 1 over epsilon. Okay.
Good question. Let's look at this. For emphasis, I will write this out. Much more detail than I normally do here. Just let C positive be a real number, not infinity, it's just a constant. And then here's what I call it. There's three cases. Okay? If C is less than 1, then I claim that the sequence of nth powers of C converges to 0. If C is equal to 1, then I claim the nth powers of C converges to 1. C is greater than 1, then I find the sequence of nth powers of C converges, well, I don't know if I say converges, but it tends to infinity. Oh, probably not a surprise to you. You're probably familiar with that. Big powers of numbers less than 1 are small. Big powers of numbers bigger than 1 are big. Big powers of 1 are just 1. But some of these proofs are pretty trivial. For example, let's get rid of these 2. Okay. Let epsilon be positive. Okay. So I need the c to the n to be epsilon close to 1 after some finite wait time. Well, I really don't have to wait at all. It's always going to be 1. So how about just no waiting at all? So starting even at n equals 0, c to the n will just be 1, because we're assuming c is 1. Well, if you're 1, then you're epsilon close to 1. Right? Your distance to 1 is 0, and hence less than epsilon. Okay? So your wait time function can just be 0. You don't have to wait at all. Okay? All right. Now, it's not obvious which one of these 1 or 3 we should try to prove next. That's something that you try one, maybe it doesn't work, maybe you try the other. In my experience, it's easier to actually prove the one about infinity first. And then you can use this little claim here to deduce the other case. All right. So my strategy will be to prove 3 and then use that to get 1. So let's call this a proof of 2 here. And I'm going to do a proof of 3 assuming 1. No, proof of 1 assuming 3. And then it'll still be my job to prove 3. Okay, so here we go. Okay, so now we're assuming C is greater than 1. Alright. So, how about this? Let B equal 1 over C. Okay, we're in case 1 here. We're going to assume 3. So in case 1, we have a C that's between 0 and 1. I want to prove it goes to 0. So we just use the fact that powers of small numbers are reciprocals of powers of big numbers. So B more over C. Then B is greater than 1. So, by case 3, which we're assuming, B to the N goes to infinity. Okay. So I'm assuming 3 to prove 1. And now what? Now I take the reciprocal. So now I use the claim over there. So C to the N is 1 over B to the N. And there that goes to 0. So if we can actually prove 3, then we can just use reciprocals to get 1.
So far I've done all the easy stuff. The hard part is still before me.
So to prove the last part, I'm going to have to actually use something with a little more depth. If I want to give you a convincing argument, I need to reduce things to something that is simpler. Right? If I did an argument where basically I solve for n by taking a logarithm, that's not going to be a very convincing proof, because probably powers to you are less mysterious than logarithms, so that really wouldn't be a help. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to use the binomial theorem to reduce this problem to just basic arithmetic. That would be the trick. Now proof of 3. Okay, so we have C is greater than E. Let R equals C minus 1. Okay? Remember, we're assuming C greater than 1. Then R is positive. Because we're just subtracting 1 from a number greater than 1. Now, you bring the binomial. C to the N is now, in terms of our R, it's 1 plus R, right? If R is C minus 1, then C is 1 plus R. So now we use the binomial theorem. So now this is where we're going to round something complicated, a power, down to something simple. And then we'll prove the simple thing gets big when N gets big. Is that everything is positive. The R's are positive. The N's are positive, or at least zero, right? I suppose you could make N zero. But at least nothing is negative. So I can safely round all of that junk down to zero. Everything involved, remember you start subtracting 1 from the N, but you stop when you get down to 1, right? So we're not going to have any negative factors in here. So all you have is 1 plus N times R. So this is a super crude estimate. Exponential growth is much faster than linear growth. But linear growth is simpler. So I've rounded down exponential growth to linear growth using the binomial theorem. Now I can fulfill the statement. Okay, so let m be greater than 0. Then, to get cn greater than or equal to m, well, we've got our rounding down process. So if I can prove that the rounded down 1 plus nr is greater than or equal to m, then so will our bigger c to the n be. Okay. And now this is one of those things where, yep, you can solve for n. Okay. Subtract 1 from both sides, divide both sides by r. R is positive, by the way, so that won't flip the inequality. There you go. So if you wait this long, then c to the n will be greater than or equal to m, no matter what the m is. If m is a trillion, then the time you have to wait is a trillion minus 1 divided by r, where r is a c minus 1. Actually, you may not have to wait that long, but that's long enough. It's long enough for even this ridiculously rounded down linear growth to get past n. So that's a wait time. It's very pessimistic, very conservative. The real like minimal wait time is going to be shorter, but we've shown that there is a wait time by rounding things down till it was so. To something so simple that we could actually solve for n.
Questions about that proof? The book does this proof, by the way, I might add, in section 3.4. Three cases of the powers. Nothing super novel here. It really feels like they turned off the air conditioning in here, doesn't it?
Oh, yes.
The story I was told about that by the administrators is that the A&M system has this scheme where to save money, there's these bureaucrats in College Station that every once in a while decide, you know what, it's time to turn off the air conditioners for a while, lower electricity. So somebody in College Station has decided to turn down our electricity, which is basically. I think they could have picked a better time, though. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Actually saves money is because you can get a reduced rate from your utility if you're a big user, but you're willing to
turn down your usage at periods of high demand. Right? That's how you get the discount.
Somebody that is inflexible and always wants, you know, enough electricity to do whatever they want has to pay a little bit more. And if you're a big user, well, a little bit more, that should be a lot more. I guess they're saving it.
Okay. Here's another one. How could we prove this one? It's one thing to think about first is, do you believe that? Does that look plausible? Looks plausible to me. I mean, when I think about this, when n is large, the n cubed is going to be even larger, and subtracting a 1 is not going to change things much. 1,000 cubed is 1,000,000,000. I subtract 1 from 1,000,000,000. Big deal. 1,000,000,000 is 10 to the 9th. The square root of 1,000,000,000 minus 1 will be roughly 10 to the 4.5. So if I make this n, you know, 10 to the 50th, then the square root of this thing will be roughly, let's see, times 3 divided by 2, about 10 to the 75th, right? Oh, pretty plausible. Okay, so that's just a question of how could I express some of those ideas algebraically. Here's one way to get at it. The fact that the 1 seems insignificant when n is large. Factor out the biggest term. And by biggest, I mean what you expect to be biggest when n is large. All right, and then look, this 1 over n cubed, that should be pretty small when n is large. And we can do a trick we did before. Let's see. If we round this n cubed, say, just down to 1, maybe. Right? Oh, wait a minute. Don't do that, because then you'll have 1 minus 1, and this will be 0. Okay, well, round it down to 2. Let's see, can I do that? Well, I mean, if n was 1, that's not quite correct, is it, right? If n is 1, then this really is 0. Okay. Start at n equals 2. Okay. There may be finally many exceptions, but after that, then this rounding down is legit. Okay? So, when n is really large, you're subtracting something really small, a reciprocal of n cubed. Okay, well, we're just going to round it down to something simpler where we subtract a little bit more. We subtract 1/2. Okay. So this is how I more formally capture that idea that 1 is pretty much nothing compared to a big N cubed. I round up, you can think of it as I round it up to, well, it's certainly not more than 1/2 of the N cubed. N is big. I didn't quite round it down. You know, I couldn't just replace it with nothing exactly, but I replaced it with 1/2. Good enough. Right? Because now you can let m be positive, and this is something I could actually solve for m. So this is what we want, and that is implied by having our rounded down thing being big enough. Okay. So we're going to show that our rounded down thing eventually gets bigger than m and stays bigger than m. And it's so simple you can just solve for n, right? Everything is positive, right? It's n cubed times a half. So square both sides. You're not going to change the ordering of the numbers. Right? That would only happen if you were squaring some negative numbers. Or if one was negative and one was positive, then you might flip the order. And, okay, well, we need to do a little bit more to solve. And, okay, multiply by 2, take the cube root. So if you wait that long, that's long enough. Very, very conservative estimate. You don't really need to wait that long in general, but it's long enough. The reason I say it's a conservative estimate is because we know that this 1 over n cubed will be a lot smaller than a half when n is really large. So it was a very crude rounding, but for just proving the qualitative fact that this goes to infinity, and not worrying about deciding exactly how fast it goes to infinity, you know, that crude rounding does the job. So as long as you are willing to agree with me that, you know, square roots and cube roots exist, then sure, that's a proof. Of course, if you don't agree with me about roots yet, if you want to see proofs that they exist, well then we shouldn't even be talking about this yet, because there's a square root right there in the statement. Question and comments about this proof. This one I'm going to prove by using some stuff I've already done before. I know that if I take a power of something that's bigger than 1, and I take bigger and bigger powers, I already know that goes to infinity. I proved that over there with the binomial theorem. So, and I did this earlier in class today. So what if I want to use those instead of having to do them all over again? Well, what would I have? I'm going to abstract out and forget about whatever specific wait time functions I cooked up for these. And I'll just take it as given that they exist, and that'll be good enough. Okay? Let m be positive. Okay. Now, what am I going to do? Well, by assumption, I have wait time functions for these. So what should I call them? How about p and q? Okay. You know, actually, I don't want to pick the m yet. I want to state the general. The general existence of these functions here. So let P and M be such that for all M positive, we have two things. If you wait P of M long, then 1.3 to the N, it is greater than or equal to M. If you wait q of m long, then the square root of n is greater than or equal to n. Okay. So I have two weighting functions. I'm going to put them together to make a weighting function for my new sequence here that just added together the old sequences.
So here's what we do. You can just do something really easy. How about we just take the maximum of these two? Whichever one tells us to wait longer, we wait that long. Okay. That'll work. Then given any m greater than or equal to 0, if you wait this long, then when you add together these two things, 1.3 to the n plus the square root of n, how big will it be? Well, the first term will be at least m. Second term will be at least m. Well, m is positive, so that's bigger than n. So 2 m's is bigger than 1 m. So when we add them together, we get something bigger than m. Done. That was waiting long enough. Yeah.
You could improve on that proof ever so slightly in one sense.
If I could have used, I could have plugged in an m over 2 here, and then I would have gotten m over 2's that added up to an m,
instead of 2 m's, which is more than I need.
But this proof is, I think, the simplest proof.
And you can generalize this, right?
You can take this very... I mean, there's nothing special about these two sequences. I didn't use any special knowledge about them. All I used was the fact that they went to infinity and hence had these waiting functions that witnessed that tendency to infinity. If I just replace the 1.3 and the square root of n with abstract sequences, then I get a more general claim. A sub n goes to infinity, B sub n goes to infinity. Then, yes, if you add them together, it goes to nothing. The proof would be exactly this proof, except everywhere you see a 1.3 at the n, replace it with an a sub n. Everywhere you see the square root of the n, replace it with a b sub n. So this example generalizes. What if you wanted to do something similar with finite limits? Only wrinkle is you will here. I didn't need to divide the m by 2, but this time I'll need to divide the epsilon by 2. It's the same kind of argument. Let p and q of epsilon be such that they witness the two limit statements I'm assuming we get, just like over here. Now, for all epsilon positive, what do we have? We have two things. Right? The p of epsilon will witness the convergence to k. So we'll have that if n is greater than or equal to p of epsilon, we've waited long enough to guarantee that a sub n is epsilon equals to k. And if n is greater than or equal to q of epsilon, then we've waited long enough for b sub n to get epsilon close to L. Guaranteed. Alright. So how long do we need to wait for an plus bn to be epsilon close to k? Down here. An plus bn to epsilon close to k plus L.
The idea is recall that if X is, say, delta close to X prime, and Y is epsilon close to Y prime, then that implies that X plus Y is delta plus epsilon close to Y plus Y prime.
We just need to use this fact here. This follows from the triangle inequality. If you don't recall it, you can prove it using absolute values in the triangle inequality. But I believe we did this in a previous class today. Okay, so I just use that. So my idea is, okay, if I want to get the sum, the an plus the bn, say epsilon close, how about I get the individual sum ands, epsilon over 2 close? And the epsilons over 2 will add up. So I let n of epsilon be maximum of two things now. So it's like here, but now it's p of epsilon over 2 and q of epsilon over 2. Good. Yes, it should. You're absolutely right. Thank you. Okay. So now we have that n greater than or equal to n of epsilon implies what? It implies that n is greater than or equal to each of those two things. So you get that an is epsilon over 2 close to k, and bn is epsilon over 2 close to l, because by definition of our n of epsilon, we've waited long enough for both of these closeness requirements to be met, just using an epsilon over 2. And that implies that you've waited long enough that you can safely add them together without getting more than epsilon away from your target. So these are what are called limit laws. If you have some sequences and you assume something about their limits, then you can put the sequences together and you get another limit for free. It's free net. You have to prove the limit law once. But then you've got it. And then you can just use it.
Okay. So we'll talk about some more limit laws next time, I think. Okay. Questions or comments? I will see you on Monday or in my Thursday office hours.